And welcome to Here We Stand. I am your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's March 29th. And any of you who have been tuning in this last week and who follow our work at murderbydecree.com will notice a posting we did. And I really advise any of you who are tuning in for the first time to go to that. It's an emergency action call in response to the bogus virus, and we'll talk about that. It's a virus, definitely, but it's overinflated, the danger. We're going to talk about some of the reasons for that today. But in response to that, we basically declare that a state of war exists. Our basic rights of assembly, of speech, of anything that we considered normal up to this point is suddenly gone. Churches are even told you can't even gather together and worship. The government tells people to jump, and they all seem to be jumping. But some of us aren't jumping, and that's why we're here today. We realize now that we've got an option. There's an alternative to tyranny and being afraid of our own shadow, being afraid of walking next to somebody in the store, being told we're not allowed to. And that alternative is resistance. Now, we've had a long history of that. As we mentioned in that broadcast, for 5 years now in Canada, we've been preparing an alternative jurisdiction that people can stand under to defy these draconian measures, the Republic of Canada. And you can find a lot of the reference to that in a book that you can get on Amazon through my name, Kevin Annett, The Case for Canada. We won't go into the detail about that now, except it's a very basic idea, and we're going to be talking about that today with my guest, Deb Golding. And that's simply the fallacy of trusting the existing system and the need to be self-reliant and how it's possible to do that. We're going to talk about that today. With that, we also want to, you know what I'm going to do now? We're going to play that broadcast, and I want you to listen to this, and after that, we're going to come back live.
Hello, this is an emergency action alert issued by the Provisional Council of the Republic of Canada. It's March the 26th, 2020. This announcement is issued under the common law jurisdiction of the Republic of Canada, formerly the Dominion of Canada. Under the guise of a fraudulent health emergency, a global police state is being imposed on we the people. A state of war now exists between humanity and a global corporatocracy. The freedom of assembly, of movement, and public dissent have been banned in many countries. Arbitrary arrests without cause are mounting, and martial law is being imposed in America, Canada, and most European nations. COVID-19 is not a reference to a flu virus, but is the military code word for permanent martial law. Well, yesterday that martial law went into effect in Canada. By an unlawful vote of only 32 of the 338 members of Parliament, the puppet Canadian government stood down and transferred its authority and tax-levying power to an executive body under the authority of the so-called Queen's Privy Council. Prime Minister Trudeau has been confined to his home under a cover story of being in self-imposed quarantine. What in fact has been quarantined is democracy. One of the first measures of this rump governing body has been the levying of a massive new tax on Canadians to fund the largest financial handout to big oil companies in our history, a secret $55 billion subsidy to PetroChina and other Asian corporations operating without restraint on Canada's west and north coasts. Under the guise of a health emergency, a tyrannical corporatocracy has assumed power. We understand that this takeover is part of a bigger corporate agenda that is now in effect and is being fast-tracked under the fog of war. Its aim is to use mandatory microchipped vaccinations and 5G electromagnetism to directly control the lives and thoughts of the world's populace as a prelude to possible global depopulation. The proof of this genocidal plan has been conclusively demonstrated for many years by scientific and political authorities, and it's unfolding as I speak. Its murderous methods have been tested and perfected upon generations of Aboriginal children in the church-run Indian residential schools and hospitals. Our own domestic genocide that Canadians have ignored at their own peril. For now, the same crime is being inflicted on all of us. The only question now is how we, the free people of Canada and the world, will resist and overcome this tyranny. Well, here in Canada, we have been preparing for this onslaught for over 5 years. Since January of 2015, our movement to disestablish a criminally convicted Crown Authority in Canada and raise up a free republic has equipped people in every province with a new allegiance and a new citizenship. Those citizens of Canada have begun to organize local common law courts and assemblies. They've issued stand-down orders to Crown officials and organized neighborhood policing under common law sheriffs to protect their children and their liberties. As embryonic as this is, the new society within the shell of the old Canada now constitutes our first line of defense against the descending police state. Our Republic of Canada is a refuge for anyone who refuses to go along with the corporate tyranny and its genocidal agenda. We state again, a state of undeclared war now exists between the Canadian government, its repressive forces, and the free people of Canada. And so, to defend our lives and liberties, we declare that we, the people under common law jurisdiction, do not recognize the statutes or the authority of the Canadian rump government, its courts, or its police. We have declared our independence from that entire system. Instead, we stand under the constituted authority of our free sovereign republic and its proclamation of independence of January 15, 2015. We will defend our lives, our liberties, and our republic by any means necessary. For us, it is now liberty or death. Accordingly, the Provisional Council of the Republic is today forming self-defense groups to protect our communities against the attacks of a corporate police state. These citizen militias will operate under the constitutional authority of the Republic. As part of their mobilization, we are today issuing to the members of the RCMP and local municipal police across Canada a call made under international and common law. That call is for them to stand down from their oath of allegiance to a foreign criminal power called the Crown of England and its puppet government in Ottawa. We invite them to be deputized as officers of the Sovereign Republic of Canada. The same call and offer is also issued today to every civil servant, judge, and soldier in Canada. Whether here or abroad, it is time for public officials to serve the people and not foreign and corporate criminal powers. To our allies in other countries and to all freedom-loving people around the world, we call on you today to take the same steps towards sovereign independence and self-defense wherever you live. That independence begins in our own minds when we resolve to say no to tyranny and suffer anything rather than surrender our natural liberty. All of you who are listening have an alternative to fear and surrender to tyranny. You can unite under the new jurisdiction of common law republics and assert your own inborn sovereignty and independence. You can and must let go of your learned helplessness and dependence on the very authorities that are now seeking your enslavement and your eventual destruction. Each of you can begin by doing two things. Take the pledge of citizenship to the Republic and join or form a local Republican neighborhood defense group. It is time to say an active no to the apartheid system of so-called social distancing by which the corporatocracy is psychologically conditioning us and preparing us for internment camps. We will not walk in fear of one another. We will not fall for their lies. Our movement will commence the first of our many public defiance campaigns between April 15th and April 30th, and these will escalate throughout the spring and the summer with your help. Our Republican militias will defend and stop the arrest of targeted individuals, including by working with our West Coast Common Law Court of Justice that's commencing on March 30th in Vancouver. Our people will spread hope and freedom in the minds of both our friends and our foes. Our time is now. You can contact us at republicofcanada@gmail.com, follow murderbydecree.com and its publications, but most importantly, every week, tune in to the Voice of the Republic, our online radio program called Here We Stand, which is live every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, and 11 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, at bbsradio.com/herewestand. The next step is up to each one of you. This is the announcement of the Provisional Republic of Canada, March 26th. Carry it on and stay tuned for more.
And we're back. This is Kevin Annett with you and with Deb Golding. Welcome, Deb.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's good that you've been a co-host for the last number of weeks. I'd love to carry on some of our discussions, but as I mentioned before that recording, I would really like to focus on the whole question of how people become self-reliant, how they learn to say no, because as we know, we're dealing with a lot of programming we all get at a young age, and it's hard to challenge our own programming when we're in a condition of fear where we're very much in a condition of war where people are saying, you have to do this or you're going to die. And, you know, the scaremongering about the Sukhoi flu virus. So I'd like to get into that a little bit. But just a reminder for people listening for the first time, as you know from, or people who regularly tune in, we have announced a number of months ago that a West Coast Common Law Court of Justice is convening on March 30th. That's tomorrow. It is going ahead. We're not holding it in public because, frankly, we can't find any public places that are willing to have us. The arrangements were had to be changed, and so it is convening. Some of the stuff we're looking into is the whole ongoing cause of, you know, these crimes, the whole issue of missing people all over the West Coast, the intrusion of Chinese corporations into the economy, this kind of thing, and the hard evidence that people have come up with over the last few months. And so this is going to be put before the court, including an application that I have put forward, which we can talk about a bit later. But that's an update on that. And the second point before Deb and I start in is you may know of the block watch systems. You have these all over the world, really, especially in North America. These are sometimes they call it block watch or parent watch committees, where you just keep an eye on your neighborhood for, you know, to take care of kids and that. Well, what's interesting is that it's hard for people to start up something new. So we have often urged, and this has started up actually, we're working with existing neighborhood watch committees and saying, look, the danger now is even greater. Let's even look past our particular fears and start working together on a local level to just keep our neighborhoods under monitoring and surveillance, not simply about the flu, but about anything, including police knocking in the doors of people. So that's one thing we urge to people. Work with the existing neighborhood watch committees that exist. But like I said, and we're working on alternatives in terms of the Republic Sheriff training that's going on as well, getting our own common law sheriffs to rally people in their own defense. Deb, wanted to ask you, in previous shows, we went into a little bit about your experience, how you were able to overcome these, if you like, your own programming in fear as a survivor of these cult ritual tortures, having to do with the Mormon Church. But I think it's especially relevant now to kind of examine a little bit of that. So I kind of explore your thoughts a little bit about on that before we get into other things.
Wow, that's pretty extensive, actually.
I'm sorry.
We're not going to go into the whole thing, but what you actually just asked me to comment on was really something that was evolving. And the first thing that I believe in this whole, just to answer your question, was me becoming aware that ability for me to choose to be able to say no was actually available to me. And as weird as that sounds, that really was the case. I mean, many of us are in a position where the herd mentality isn't quite framed as herd mentality, but we want to belong. And without really knowing that going against the grain is part of just even, you know, variations and just exploration or variety, it's definitely beat down. In a cult situation, you know?
You were telling me a specific example of how, Homeland Security made this big pretense that it was investigating people who had been tortured and who suffered these crimes in Utah. And they took all these testimonies over 10 years, apparently. Nobody knew about it. And it turns out that all along, they knew they couldn't do anything anyway because of a statute brought in 2000, statute of limitations, saying, no, you can't sue if you survive these tortures. So they knew all along that it was bullshit, and yet they were gathering, basically information gathering. We saw the same process in Canada with the residential schools and that. And so I think that's an example of people, you know, survivors want to trust authority. They want to think that Big Brother is going to help them. And then they get sucked in and they use, because no doubt the Homeland Security is handing over all that information to the Mormon Church, to the government, as they've done in so many other times. So let's talk a little bit about that, about, how we can get people to see you can't trust system that did these crimes.
Well, in where I was going with that, and thank you for bringing up that the Homeland Security thing, because I have personal experience with that. I was and have been approached by three different individuals, independent of each other, that have, you know, really good hearts, actually. They're just like, oh, my goodness, these atrocities. I have a friend that told me, or I know a victim about this or whatever. And in each case, it's like, guess what? You know, and almost a little bit of, you know, edge of hope on their voice. I was like, would you be willing to go talk to Homeland Security? They're gathering these things. They're mounting an investigation against the church. There's so many testimonies, and they're going to create this case, you know. And every time, because of my own experience, knowing that the government is involved in all of the ritual and all of the cult and all of the satanic and all of the stuff that I was involved in, it's not just a church. It is a system. And the system has, you know, members and participants and people in all of these factions. So it was very easy for me to say, no, thank you. You know, no, I'm not going to do that.
You have the experience.
And I had the experience to be able to say, that's dangerous. I will not do that. I'm not going to approach that or give over my information for that, because I know, based on where I've been, that information is only just, it's basically a campaign to get names and then also data to say, well, what are people remembering? What are people, you know, what is spontaneously coming up? Who are they? And let's see if we can, do we need to reaccess them? Do we need to let their handlers know? Do they need to be tortured again? Do they need to be put in submission? Do they need to be put into the, you know, mental institution? Do we need to activate another, you know, program in them that they kill themselves? I mean, there's so many things that were going on with the data collection. And when I learned from two of the other individuals that this particular thing has been going on, they were told that they've been getting these witnesses, and they've been talking to witnesses for over 10 years. And, you know, that what that does is it boosts this this idea that, oh, good, somebody's going to take care of it, somebody that has power, somebody. So then the victims or the people that are willing to offer information do so very willingly. They just walk right through the door, and they're willing to say, yes, let me give you this information. Yes, let me. We're in partnership, right? And they don't think to ask those questions necessarily.
Well, and then
as
we know,
they want their stories known.
It's set up to, you know, create hope in people and then take it away. And this is what you use in standard torture training. You create a bit of hope, take it away. Create hope, take it away, and that psychologically breaks the strongest person. And I see that in survivors all the time. The government said, oh, they're going to issue an apology. And then they don't admit anything, and nothing changes, right?
Well,
and
so not only survivors, but it also does put people who don't even have experience with it that are trying to help survivors and get very invested, and then have placed, and it's, you know, they feel very an honest trust in who has been deemed and labeled the authority figure, and then now all of these people are like, well, why try? Yeah, so now they've gone through, and it's like a side. They just went through with one fell swoop, and now what do we do? Well, nothing. So now nothing happens. It's just so deflating.
Yeah, and I, you know, that's not only the point, but it's all a program of study and experimentation. And whether it's the Mormon Church or the residential schools, whatever, the methods that are now being tried out on everybody, they know what to do because it's worked on other groups. And I often say to people, like, you know, why are we worried about what might happen to us now? It's the same thing's been happening to a lot of other people up to now, but you didn't pay any attention to it or care about it. But we're supposed to care about it now because it's happening to you. It doesn't work that way. You know, we reap what we've sown. If we ignore this happening to other groups and that, of course it's going to happen to us. So now people are scrambling. But, you know, the reality is that it's happening. It's now targeting everybody. And as much as people deny it, it's right on our doorstep. I mean, you cannot assemble anymore. It's now illegal.
Exactly. It is. It's right there. And people are willingly, again, you know, going with the idea, because the majority is saying this is what's necessary. And to step up against that is, you know, deemed a health hazard. To step up against that is, you know, publicly, just blocked. There's a lot that, you know, they're on that. So, I mean, I'm looking at this, and I'm knowing your story and as we've connected more and more and I learn more about it, I know that in there have been some really sad things that have happened here where people put their faith in the in what they think is authority and then everything gets ripped out from underneath them and it's just decimating. But I want to know how you got around all of this in Canada, because I don't know if there's very many success stories in standing up or speaking about all of this, about, you know, something that is really just with, well, you know, putting your voice in authority. I mean, if you did certain things to contain or to maintain a voice. So what exactly did you do?
Canada is the only place where this stuff was forced out as a result of a grassroots movement. And it's something we started as far back as 1996. And it's a very important lesson to learn. Whether it's about the 5G shit now, the flu virus, the police state, it's all the same struggle we have. And the only reason that information came out and the government apologized for residential schools and they had their bogus Truth and Reconciliation Commission because of a decision a few of us made early on is that we would not cooperate with the system. We would be the source of our own information. We would uncover the crimes ourselves. We would publish it ourselves. We would confront the people and the institutions that did it, the churches, the governments. We started occupying churches, protesting it. We made it uncomfortable for them, and they had to respond. And that was two dozen of us at most across the country that forced this change. We could have had 10,000 out with picket signs asking for change from the government like protests do, and it wouldn't have had the effect of that two dozen, because what we did is we, like Sun Tzu says in The Art of War, and I want to get into talking a little bit about Sun Tzu later, you know, during the show, but Sun Tzu says it doesn't matter what your size is. If you attack what your enemy loves, they are forced to respond on your terms. And that's proven. Justin Trudeau, mini Trudeau, started using the word genocide. Nobody used that word in Canada except us for many years, and now they are. And you could say, well, they've co-opted the issue. No, they haven't. They responded to the terrain we established, and that's how it came out. Now, you know, the lesson is right there, but what I find is people don't want to accept the lesson because that means, hey, we can do it, and we have to take responsibility for doing it, and there's risk in that. And people would rather sit in their holes and not take risk and lose. That's my experience, but there's a few who aren't like that, and that's what the show is aimed at. Those few who are willing to follow on our example and confront these people, because the people in power are a lot more vulnerable than we realize. That's why they have to scare us with these tactics. All we have to do is start saying no, and their whole system starts crumbling. You know, five people get together and say, we're not going to social distance, and watch what happens. You're going to trigger that in others, and this is what we found in practice happens. It's, you know, a paper tiger, as somebody once said. You know, it's the threat of the state is mostly imagined. And we've proven how to do that. So I think that that's important to keep in mind, especially, and here's a fact I want to throw at you. There's a really good article that came out recently, which actually shows that talking about this flu virus is only half the issue, because coronavirus is not lethal unless it's combined with something else, and that something else happens to be extreme electromagnetic energy, otherwise known as 5G, because according to this research in China, and as a matter of fact, they've started releasing people from hospitals all over China after massive vitamin C intravenous treatment. They found that in Wuhan, where this first broke out, it was the most heavily 5G city in the world. And what happens with, let me read from the scientific study from Shigeko Hakusui, who's a scientist. He says, 5G allows 98% oxygen absorption rate, which is necessary for the transmission of energy more effectively. So in other words, what he's saying by that is that the effect of the 5G on the human body is it sucks the oxygen out of your system. It causes people to go into shock and makes them more prone. Their immune system crashes, and yes, then they're more prone to this coronavirus, which is a fairly mild virus. It's in us all the time. More people have died from normal virus last year, 80,000 deaths in the U.S., 3,500 deaths in Canada last year from normal flu virus. And yet, we're supposed to panic over a 10% death rate, of that. And so obviously there's other factors involved in this. So we have to use our own judgment, look through the lies and realize, no, there's another agenda going on here.
No, it's you and I were at one point we're talking about saying no and authority. And you said something I thought was really fascinating along the lines of the majority being unreliable because they tend to reflect who the authority is and they don't really have any experience. So it would be necessary to have the minority be the ones to stand up and lead that. And these are the people that are the activists and the ones that are writing the articles and things like that. There's so much disinformation, though. It's like, how does one filter through? I mean, basically, I think what comes down to it, it takes a little bit of responsibility. And where you start with your responsibility always is with yourself. And so in that self-responsibility, I would say one of the things that's really, we talked about this last week about being active versus reactive, you know, and the reactions of coming from that stem from fear are easily tracked. I mean, this is one of the data. It's easy. You can put out something like this and watch the waves of what happens across the nation, the world, the state, whatever, on how people react based on that fear. And so it's a reaction. So if you want to take it down to the personal level and say, before we start into really just getting reactive to things, notice that about yourself. It's like, wow, I am really angry about this thing, or I'm really afraid about this thing, or I really am like against this article, or I'm really for this article. And none of that is wrong. All of that is just information. So if you can take that information and you can calm yourself and say, okay, why does this appeal to me? Why am I offended by that? Why is this something that I want to reject and like, you know, just want to rip it up and burn it? I mean, all of that.
Yeah, but you're getting done. I'm sure we're having technical problems in the show today, but he's going to call you back because there's a lot of breakup happening in your phone. I don't know why, but would you mind just, he'll call you right back and bring you back on.
Okay.
And for listeners, I did want to carry on one thing Deb mentioned, and this is, I urge people very much to get our two manuals, Truth Teller Shield, a manual for whistleblowers and hellraisers, and also the Common Law Training Manual. Both of them on Amazon, put in the name Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T. Now, in both of them at the back, we reprint 50 of the main maxims or rules put up by Sun Tzu in The Art of War. And the one she mentioned obliquely was that you cannot depend on the majority. And this kind of goes against our democratic principles in that. But Sun Tzu says, in battle, whoever depends on a majority for victory must reflect its weakest aspects and is therefore defeated. Seasoned minorities alone are capable of sustained and purposeful action, and through that victory. Only veterans are capable of victorious combat by leading the inexperienced mass in their wake. So that leadership of veterans is key to victory in every battle, and I want to really emphasize that to people listening. There's some of you out there who have been through this. You know the lessons. You need to organize and not, you know, we hear this from people all the time. Oh, everyone around me is so apathetic and afraid. Well, of course they are. They're the 99%. They're conditioned that way. They haven't risen above that yet. You don't look to them. You look to yourself, and you look to people hopefully like you who are say, yes, I see the problem, and I want to take action, and I'm willing to risk and take action and give up anything rather than lose my liberty. And if we have to organize that minority first, they're the leadership. So that's a very different focus than kind of the broad democratic notion of, well, we're going to just educate people. It doesn't work. Are you there, Deb?
Yes, I'm here. And I'd like to comment on what you just said there. It's a responsible action. What you just got done saying, I recognized as something where people can choose into acting that way when they see themselves as a sovereign person, as a viable resource. And, you know, that it matters. It matters versus just sitting back and watching. And then, you know, it is risky. It's risky if you're wanting to appeal to the masses, you know. Yes. And it's not if you want to maintain some sovereignty and say, no, this is something that the entire United States was based on a few people that wanted to do something different. They jumped on ships, for heaven's sakes, and said goodbye. Like, that's a pretty radical action, if you think about it. And they didn't take all of England and all of that. They didn't, like, just swoop up Europe and say, well, we're just going to bring everybody over here. They're just like, we're out. Like, this is what we're doing for us.
Yeah, they saw themselves as a remnant who were starting something new. Not, you know, we the people, it's a good idea. It doesn't happen in practice. And it relates to another very important principle. And I'm orienting these remarks to people who I know who are listening, who are asking the basic question, what do we do now to defend ourselves in our communities? Well, we do more than defend. We go on the offensive. We say these actions are criminal. But to do that, we've got to be organized in our own thoughts and ourselves. And here's a really basic principle. Do not respond to the ground your enemy has prepared for you. Instead, shape their ground. Then they have no alternative but to be led by you as if it was their own idea. Another way he said that is, battles are won before they ever fought. Whoever establishes the terrain of battle first wins. Whoever responds to that terrain loses. And we proved that again in Canada. We defined the issue as genocide. They eventually had to come around and admit it. And, you know, so that's true in anything. We just have to be determined and stick to our guns. No, the issue is not a flu virus. The issue is a police state and the conditions they need people in to allow that state to happen.
Well, I think that that's actually really great that you had that reframe right there for people that are listening, because there's a lot of people that are banning against this enemy called the flu, you know, the virus, versus really recognizing what you just pointed out. You know, a police state, and you know what does that actually mean? You know, what is the governing over that, and then what is going to be required of that? And I think, you know, that could get pretty extreme.
Yeah, and you know, it's easy to lose patience, and I sometimes sound like I'm impatient. Well, I guess I am by nature, but the point is that you need to acquire the long view on this. And we're in this for the long haul. This is a lifelong struggle. It's not a 3-minute soundbite kind of issue. They've shown by their actions the coordinated nature of the shutdown of our basic freedoms, this police state system. It's a coordinated response by the ruling elites at the highest level. And it's not going to go away. There's not going to be a 30-day period and then it's all going to go back together. That's what they said about Hitler. Well, no, we don't have to emigrate from Nazi Germany. It's just going to blow away. He's just a passing phase. Well, the people who thought like that ended up dead. And we already, I remember one of the things that, just a personal story, the thing that got me really involved in politics, I was 17 years old, and the military coup in Chile had happened on September 11th, interestingly enough, 1973. And I began to meet all these refugees who were trying to create a new society in Chile, right? And they were wiped out. 30,000-40,000 of them died because they were very naive. They thought you could take on the big moneyed interest peacefully for the ballot box. And I met a group of people. They were students at the University of Valparaiso, and they were in an activist group, but they saw what was coming, and they said a year before the military coup happened, they all went underground. They set up safe houses. You know, they began to operate in a different way as if they were living under a police state. And sure enough, they're the ones who survived. The others were carted up, sent away to the National Stadium, and they're executed the next day. The ones who believed in the system. And unfortunately, we're in that boat right now. And for 45 years, I've been harboring that lesson, wondering when our turn was going to come in Canada and America. And sure enough, it's upon us now. We're living it. And you know, people have said, well, you're fear-mongering. No, it's upon us now. Just look around. Use your own senses. We live under a different regime. We have to start thinking and acting differently because we are at war.
Well, I agree. Yeah, there is a difference. And this is actually one of those things where you can look at it as an opportunity to create a more empowered state within yourself or to recoil. And it doesn't mean that, it, you know, I think we all go through waves of that. You know, there's times that I'm feeling pretty, you know, I've felt like, what? I don't know what to do with this. And other times I'm like, oh, this is clear. And I know what I'm doing within myself. But really seeing it as such, because I don't, you know, this is a shift. This is definitely different. And one of the things I would love for you to, you know, tell people is the time frame the time, if, you know, just because of the patience or the thing, the consistency that you exhibited, what was the time between you using the word genocide and keeping just hanging with that word? One of the words, I'm sure there's many things that you did, but before the Canadian government and Trudeau actually adopted that and said, okay, we're going to use that word. There was genocide. So well, what was the time frame on that?
I first began to meet survivors after the United Church threw me out, January 95. By 1996, in the healing circles, I was hearing these stories, finding the documents proving a 50% death rate. And I remember at the first press conference we ever held, it was, I believe, in February 97, downtown. And at the press conference, I said, look, all of this indicates genocide. It's not physical and sexual abuse, which is the only term the media were allowed to use, and still is, you know. I said, no, it's genocide. They plan to wipe out these kids. Now, that was over 10 years before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and about 20 years before Trudeau began using the term himself, over 20 years. Now, so it's not a matter of your size. It's a matter of about your persistence. I kept saying it over and over and over, and then other people began to come forward in the survivors and said, yeah, they were trying to wipe us out. And they couldn't be denied. It could only be fogged. And that's what they do. They start smear campaigns around, and the smear campaign around me has been enormous. But, I mean, they have to get people. They can't kill me because that creates a martyr, because I'm white and I'm professional and I had exposure. And so they have to just make people afraid of me. The same way now people are afraid to talk to each other in the store or come close to each other. You're prohibited to now. They create a climate of fear so that people cannot use their mind to say, yeah, it is genocide. Yeah, we are being wiped out, right? And and so it's a slow process, but it's all about persistence. And you've got to be as stubborn as hell and never give up. And guess who's going to blink first? It'll be them, not us.
Well, I think that's the reason I wanted you to bring that out was the fact that, you know, day after day of something new, which this is, this particular police state, that, you know, stores shutting down and people trying to adapt or readapt, or when is this going to be over? I mean, within that state of being, you know, the idea and the hope is, well, let's have it go back. I want it to go back. And really and truly that it's not going to go back. That's not a fatalistic comment. It's let's create, let's go forward. But you've got to understand that some of the things that we did enjoy, we can pull forward. And some of the things that are not being allowed us, or that we can actually see with new eyes, do have different titles. You know, you use the word genocide in a particular case. This is, a police state. And there's atrocities that are being, that will be presented to us as solutions that we can look at that and go, I don't agree with that. The answer is no. That is not okay with me.
Here's something agreeing with you, one of his points. He says, place your soldiers where they cannot leave and have no alternative but to fight or die. Facing death, they find their true strength and cannot be routed. When they cannot leave, they stand firm and fight. For thus do extreme situations cause your troops to find a deeper resolve and a source of inner power. That's the point. We're always trying to protect people, but no, they have to go through getting boot. That's how you learn. And when back is to the wall, there's an instinctive reflex in human beings. Some collapse, but a lot more start fighting back. And this opportunity, now people see this as a crisis, but it's also an opportunity. This has the potential of radicalizing a lot of people and waking them up to what the government is doing. And this could easily backfire on the whole system and get people literally up in arms and stopping this. So they're playing with dynamite and they know it. They're relying on everyone's fear to get them through the next phase of, the mandatory vaccinations, depopulation, whatever, they have in store. It doesn't really matter what they plan. We already know how these people work. I often say to people, why would you trust the government that did this to generations of little children, that wiped them out? You're going to trust them? Health Canada, that's shutting down stores if people don't stand four feet apart. That same Health Canada is the one that was sterilizing Native kids for decades in Indian hospitals. You're going to trust them to tell you what to do? I mean, a little bit of knowledge is power, right?
Exactly. A little bit of knowledge is power. And I think in accordance with that, right along with what you just said about, you know, putting the soldiers or putting people in a position where they their backs are against the wall. I know there are times that it happens so quickly, or the situation, there's a bewilderment. It's like, yeah. What is going on? What? And then the reaction time of people is varied. And once it lands on you of really what is going on in your own psyche and where you go with that is a really good example for others. I mean, I'm thinking about a gal I know that really does a great job representing victims. They've come to her and talked to her. She's, you know, and she is held a place for, you know, believing their stories, and there's a camaraderie there, but there's a certain degree of strength that she has because she doesn't have their story that really she can add and support them with, where she, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, that's terrible. And then the victim that is listening or talking to him is like, oh my gosh, you're right. It really is. I mean, I knew it inside, and I've got these terrible things that go on, and I have these nightmares. But to hear somebody else say, wow, that's atrocious. You know, so that really to have somebody standing there and standing up and saying, no, what I'm seeing is this,
right.
And then being able to define what it is you're seeing kind of shakes those that are in this bewilderment of, what am I witnessing? I don't have the vocabulary for it.
Here's,
you know,
the thing.
And it's like, this is it.
When people are bewildered and are being assaulted, you don't hold their hand. You don't say, it's going to be better. You know, what you say to them is, you explain what's going on. You say, yes, you're mm-hmm. being assaulted. You have to defend yourself. I can't do it for you. You have to find that inner resolve. But here's some lessons I've gone through. It's like Colia Clark, my friend in New York City. She went through the civil rights movement. She said, we'd show up in a southern town and we'd say to people, we're not the organizers. We're a catalyst. You have to organize yourself. You know your mm-hmm. situation best. And this is what we do. We catalyze people with this program today. But anyone listening to this, you've got to take the next step and read up on how we go about forming these common law assemblies. And you've got to issue the stand-down orders to the cops. You've got to find even one person in your neighborhood willing to get together and start to find this, because otherwise I'll see you in the camp, folks. You know, it'll be that mm-hmm. that simple, right?
Well, exactly. I think where I take it to a different way of wording it is, like, I like to look at people, especially those that are in those, the victims that I've worked with, and I will say, look, I have a level of compassion for what it is that I see you're going through. What you're telling me, I can understand, but I'm going to tell you right now, as you go through your process, it's not bigger than you. You got this. I totally believe in where it is you're going to take this and how it is you're going to champion yourself. What that does for an individual is something that they've never had before. It's the truth. You do got this. You are capable. But to hear somebody else look at you, especially in a brokenness or in a bewilderedness, and say, you know what, you got this, it's really empowering. That's what I want to hear when I'm in my sadness. You know, I do want to be heard. I want to be listened to. But I want somebody to say, oh my God, you are so powerful. You got this, versus, oh, like, this is maybe what I see the religions do, or, you know, the government do. It's like, you don't know what to do. We know better than you do. We know what's best for you. Why don't you just go sit down over there, because we're going to tell you what's best for
yep.
you.
Well,
and
what,
that is,
you know,
so demeaning.
Well, and, you know, we're not all made for this. I mean, people's nature and character are different. But what I'm always, my whole method is, I go out and I look for the 1 out of 1,000 people who are already fighting. They're not waiting for permission. It's just in their nature to do it. And one of the people I know who was on the show last week with us, Brenda Everall, she didn't mm-hmm. wait. She just went out and said, you know, confronted these people who were abducting and trafficking children to Children's Aid Society in Belleville, Ontario, and Picton, Ontario. She said she started picking in their offices. She started confronting them. She didn't wait for anybody else. And her
right.
courage inspired everybody else. And they didn't arrest her. They were afraid of her, right? You become mm-hmm. you screw up their system the minute you say no, and we don't realize the power we each have in our ability to do that.
I love that you're bringing that up, you know, because it's like the question asked at the beginning of the program is, why can't we say no to authority? Why can't we? I mean, we have trouble being supported and saying no to parents or to teachers or to other authorities. They don't take the time to actually, with the child, say, oh, really? What is it that you're finding you know, that you don't like about this. It's just like, well, you do it because you said so. So we don't necessarily have the training or the support unless it's really rebellious and we just kind of expect to get beat. But, you know, there's a few places that really support a no, you know. And so I would say that's part of the reason why we can't say no to authority. And then there's this other part that we just really hope that what we've been taught is actually the truth. Well, somebody else is going to take care of it, and the authority, quote-unquote, has a bigger arm, and they're connected to more people, and even if it takes, you know, like bills to be passed or something else to be done, then somebody else will take care of it, and you kind of feel like you can wash your hands of something that's really uncomfortable.
Right. Well,
saying no is uncomfortable.
It's learned dependence, and, you know, we don't. It's kind of like the example I gave you earlier about when the biggest slave rebellion in history. People remember Spartacus, 73 mm-hmm. BC, right? He led hundreds of thousands of slaves. They almost overthrew the Roman Empire, and they defeated all these legions. Well, it wasn't the slaves that revolted. It was a hardcore of gladiators who escaped, and they were the leadership cadre. These were trained warriors, and they led the slaves and trained them, and they learned in battle how to operate. But you needed that core of gladiators first to lead everyone into battle. And that's, they almost did it. And so that's an example for us. We know who we mm-hmm. are, the ones who are trained, the veterans. Mm-hmm. But the problem here is that most of the veterans I know of these many struggles have all given up. They're despondent. And, you know, when you've been through a system, as you know, and you see the way it really is, there's a tendency to just get too aware and say, well, it's not even jadedness. It's just tiredness. It's soul weariness. Of having to deal mm-hmm. with this stuff all the time. And you don't want to have to deal with people's ignorance and naivety anymore. You just want to say, there's nothing you can do. I've tried it. But that's an irresponsibility because we have a responsibility to the next generation to teach them as elders what's gone through and to help them go through their own experiences. So I'd say that to any of the veterans working out there, we've got to unite now. We're the leadership cadre that are going to lead this revolt.
Well, I think if we can look at ourselves as that, I mean, that what a great way to feel bolstered, I would say, is to be able to compare yourself to a gladiator. I mean, I think that's pretty cool. I mean, taking someone that has been trained because of their experience and then having, as your example, the slaves look at that and say, that I can relate to. And because of their experience, I can trust that because we all agree that there's something bigger than us that is, you know, fairly oppressive and is confusing. I mean, if you look at what it is that's being put out there about, you know, the virus and this common enemy, again, there's so many things that is disinformation and truth. And it's like, what? And it's confusing. But at the same time, if you can look at somebody and say, you know, we can actually be those gladiators and we can say, this is something to fight. This is something to stand for. And I get to look at this and go, yeah, hell, I'll be a gladiator. You bet. Yeah. You know?
Now, in the 5 minutes we got left, I just want to apologize, first of all, to folks for the technical follow-up earlier. And but through this, I hope you get the message out of this show that we have to find those among us who are willing to act now and unite and organize. And, you know, people have a lot of explanations and they're all their theories, but we've been unfortunately trained for the last 20 years because of the technology that somehow posting information is an act. It isn't. It's just providing information. I don't care about debate anymore. We need to organize people in our community and provide that leadership. And we've given a model already of how to do that. But I urge people to write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com or thecommonland@gmail.com, and get on board. We've had over the last week, actually, and this is a good thing about police state tactics, is that it really increases, you know, the interest. It's like what Sun Tzu said, people know their backs are to the wall. So I've had a quadrupling in the number of people wanting to help just this last week. So I would say to those people, take action, don't wait. We've got these manuals, show you how to do it, but contact us at those emails and come on the show, talk about your own experiences. That's the purpose of this program. Deb, any final thoughts before we do our sign-off here?
Yeah, I'm actually really glad that you invited others to come on because it's empowering to know that there's others out there and they have different experiences because your experience will definitely help other people and their experiences. you know, and so being willing to ask the right questions, write to Kevin, write to the group, you know, and then get involved even this way is, I think, a really empowering thing that people can do. So thanks for the invitation.
Well, absolutely. And one thing I want to mention, too, and this is relevant to anybody in the Mormon church or anyone in any of these churches, and we don't want to get this lost in the shuffle anymore. We want to forget about the criminal law court convening in Vancouver tomorrow, that on April 12th, which is Easter, there's going to be actions at various churches because of their involvement in a lot of these ongoing crimes. Now, it's true they're closed. But, in fact, our information is that not all of them are closed. And, in fact, they're under the guise of being closed, these churches are still involved in their nefarious activities. I'll give you one concrete example that we know of. Holy Rosary Cathedral in Vancouver, where we did a lot of the actions, and it's our occupation of that cathedral that forced the apology very soon after, you know, we did that. At Holy Rosary Cathedral, we know that active child trafficking is going on. And Archbishop Michael Miller is an active member of the 12 Mile Club working out of the Vancouver Club. This is a network that traffics children. He's one of those named in the indictment of the common law court. And as we speak, that church is being used as a major trafficker because under the guise of things being shut down, these things happen all the more. So I want to urge people, don't believe just because things aren't open, it doesn't mean these crimes aren't continuing, and we need to be out at these actions. So remember, Easter, April 12th is going to be that Sunday, actions at these genocidal child trafficking churches. So don't lose that in the fog that's being created around all of these things. And I hope folks, especially in the States, take this on too, because we've got all the more evidence that this stuff continues on all the time in the United States as well.
It's atrocious. Yes.
Any thoughts on that? We've got two more minutes.
Oh, any thoughts on that? Yes, I would be vigilant and watching. You're right. Especially with people, I love what Brenda brought up last week, and I want to reiterate that, is please be aware of the children that are at home when that's where their abuse is happening. Domestic violence of men and women and children, it has increased in Utah since this has happened. There are statistics that are already showing that there's an increase of domestic and child abuse that has been reported, and that part needs to be made aware of, and we need to be looking at that too. So there's a lot of things to consider here. Yeah,
we'll carry this on. Thank you.
Thanks again
for being on. And this is an ongoing struggle, as we both know. I appreciate you being on. I know it's always hard to get into stuff that's personal, not just an abstract issue, but that you've suffered yourself. So thank you once again. Finally, in closing, folks, to remind you that you can follow all of the work and the evidence behind what we're doing, murderbydecree.com, and also go to ITCCS updates under that website for the regular news of our work. We're going to close on a good song. I actually use this song when I do funerals sometimes. It's called The Parting Glass. And we're going to be back next week, same time. Until then, be strong, be clear.